afternoon proceedings in case 83605 in regard to the parental rights of GRS. My understanding is you all have entered into some time-sharing agreements, yes? So that I believe on behalf of appellant, there's going to be 5 minutes utilized in the beginning of the argument with respondent child having 5 minutes thereafter, and then you all wish to reserve respondent child to have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Correct.
And then obviously the state will have a full 15-minute complement. All right, Justice Perigueux, are you ready up in Carson?
I sure am.
All right, Mr. Santa Croce, you can proceed, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Frederick Santa Croce. My bar number is 5121, and I represent the appellate in this case, Brandon S. We are brought here today because this case came into the attention of DFS and CPS when a complaint was filed against my client regarding an incident where he was alleged to have pulled his daughter's hair and possible drug usage. DFS attempted to serve a warrant on my client with the aid of Metro. They went to his house. He opened the door. He refused to relinquish the child. Metro took no action at that point in time, because as they said, they didn't see any risk of harm or danger to the child. Nevertheless, a petition was filed and a hearing was held, and the court substantiated the charges against my client. A case plan was put forth. He was required to do certain things in order to be reunified with his child, and basically, the district court said he didn't do those particular things. For example, they said that he failed to make necessary adjustments. But I want to paint a picture for this court as to the time period that this case was going on. It was in the middle of a pandemic, the likes of which we haven't seen in most of our lifetimes. Things were curtailed. Services weren't provided. This court, in fact, issued administrative orders which attempted to alleviate the burden that the pandemic caused on the justice system. Jury trials were postponed. Arraignments were postponed. There was even an infringement on the constitutional right to a speedy trial because of this pandemic. But to my knowledge, no consideration was given in family court matters. No consideration was given to mothers and fathers that had to meet certain criteria in case plans. And that was the case here. Despite that, and as things started to loosen up, my client did do certain things that were required of him. For example, he submitted to a domestic violence assessment where it was administered a Fitzpatrick test where he scored 6 out of 36 factors, which indicated that he was low on the anger scale. He participated and successfully completed the Triple P program, positive parenting program. He completed anger management, relapse prevention, MRT with healthy minds, and he attempted therapy 1 time per week. Now, granted, this was toward the end of the time period that the court was faced with. And the court had a lot of pressure on it to meet statutory time periods. And they felt that, hey, we've got to push this thing along. So the state filed their motion to terminate parental rights. A hearing was held. Several hearings were held, in fact. The court recognized that my client had made progress. The court recognized that he had been arrested. I should point this out to the court. He had been arrested on a probation violation toward the end of this period of time, and he was reinstated on probation with the condition that he attend and complete drug court program. So as the TPR trial was going on, he was in the drug court program. He was released out of custody, and he was doing the drug court program. He was being tested weekly, drug tested weekly by the drug court program, and he was also submitting to random drug tests by CPS. All of those drug tests came up negative. But the court was concerned and opined that, gee, he's doing great in a supervised environment, but how's he going to do in the unsupervised environment? He was due to graduate from drug court in April. The court, in my opinion, feeling the pressure of the statutory time limits, decided to go forward with the termination hearing. They went forward with the hearing. They ultimately terminated my client's parental rights.
Let me take you back for just a moment. I think it's fair to characterize the record as showing a decided change in terms of your client's approach to things after incarceration versus before. But other than parenting classes, what was it that limited his ability to do things before incarceration because of the COVID pandemic?
Well, we've submitted an email from Sarah Beers, who administered court programs, to Danae Williams, who was the CPS supervisor in this right. case, telling them that they had to lay off 28 part-time employees and they couldn't provide the services, and that once they started rehiring again, then they could provide the services. So that had a big part of what was going on in this case.
Okay.
Has he since completed drug court?
Yes. Successfully, I might add. I see my time is up, so I just want to point out to the court it'd be a real travesty to terminate his parental rights, given the facts, the circumstances, the environment in which we were living at the time, and not neglecting the best interest of the child in this case. The CAP attorney expressed to the judge in this case that this child wanted to be reunited with her father, that she had a strong bond with her father. Her father wasn't an absent father. During this whole time period, he had frequent visitation with his child, and that was due to the cooperation of the placement parents, and we're appreciative of that. So he's not estranged from his daughter. They have a strong connection, and with that, I'll yield my time to Mr. Smith.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, Abe Smith for the minor child. I think the question in this case is whether Chapter 128 allows for a parent's redemption, or whether the disease of addiction is such a stain and it's too permanent that we can't consider a person's later sobriety and efforts to rectify that. I'm standing here to represent my client's interest, the minor child, who's now almost 8 and still to this day desires to be reunited with her father and opposes the state's efforts to terminate a parental bond with her father. As Mr. Santacroce pointed out, the father's been consistent, had always been consistent with visitations, providing a home, providing medical care, offering financial support, even while the child was with another family, providing groceries, cooking for the family, et cetera. He even tried to provide cash, which they declined. The court had two principal concerns. One was, of course, his drug use, and the other had to do with the initial cause for the abuse and neglect petition, for which he was required to do domestic violence, go through a domestic violence program. So I'll address both of those issues. But I want to start out with emphasizing my client's desires and how that the role that that plays in the best interest analysis. I think the district court here, it skipped over the client desire part, which is in 128.1702. Instead, it focused on comments made by the CAP counsel about being in a quandary, and I can provide context to that. But it's important to underscore that the order contains no analysis of the child's capacity to express her own desires with respect to reunification. So this issue about which is what the court relies on, that the CAP counsel was in a quandary. Well, I think that's for two reasons. One, of course, was that this trial was a combined trial with mom and dad, and CAP counsel and the child did not oppose the termination of mom's rights, even though she did oppose the termination of dad's rights. And as to dad, counsel stated that he should be given the opportunity to continue to demonstrate his efforts, give him the opportunity to fully demonstrate to this court that he is the safe parent that you need to meet the best interests of this child. The state then misrepresents this in their supplemental reply brief at page 11 to be an admission that termination is in the child's best interest. No, we've never admitted that termination is in the child's best interest. In fact, we today reaffirm that the child desires to be reunited to her father. Now, the other issue I have with the district court's order has to do with the timing. And I think the district court felt unreasonably constrain in bringing this case to a conclusion once it had all of the evidence in front of it. We've set out in our brief the colloquy that the district court had in in April 2021, after the first day of trial, and the court learned that the dad was in drug court, and the trial court wanted to give the father an opportunity to complete that program. She said, if drug courts truly do work, this is at 2@431 in our appendix, if drug courts truly do work, I want to make sure that I give him at least an opportunity to demonstrate that he's going to be compliant and make genuine changes. The problem was that later in the July 2021 status check, the court learned that DFS was not on board with providing that opportunity and was unable, they said that they would be unable to assess the father until after the completion of the drug court, which was not going to be until March or April of 2022. And so at that point, the district court, I think, got frustrated and said, well, I can't let this case drag on. And we've seen some references to a federal statute, which, again, this is the district court is not under an obligation to complete.
That's a question I have. I mean, what, if any, legal impediment was there to the court deciding we're going to go ahead and set this out another 4 months until the gentleman either finishes or fails the drug court program?
None whatsoever. The district court would have been fully within its discretion to continue the trial, to get the final assessment that the DFS claimed that it needed to do. I mean, there's no question that at the time of trial, he was completely sober, that he'd gone through. In fact, there was an issue with the domestic violence. He'd started with Legal Rehab Services, LRS, but that program said that while he was in drug court, they weren't willing to continue with his domestic violence program. So then he went over and did SafeNest instead. So that issue was resolved, although he was, you know, continuing to participate in those classes at the time of trial. The only issue was the DFS said, look, he's in a controlled environment with the threat of incarceration hanging over his head. Even though he was no longer in the sober living home, he was living on his own at the time on day three of the trial. The state was concerned it's too controlled of an environment. We can't assess him until he's out of that environment. Well, in that case, the district court should have continued the trial. Either it could have said, well, the evidence here certainly doesn't demonstrate that he's not become sober, or if you needed to wait for that assessment, then actually do that assessment. Give him a chance. Give him the chance that the district court said it wanted to give him to complete drug court, and then evaluate him in that so-called non-controlled environment. Again, the state cites to, I think it's 42 U.S.C. 675, which is the federal funding statute for foster care programs. And number one, there are exceptions to that, to the timelines there, one of which applies here when there's a placement with a relative. And two, that's only a deadline for filing a motion to terminate parental rights. It's not a deadline imposed on state courts to actually make a decision on the termination of parental rights. So under Nevada law, the district court should have extended that trial. If Your Honor has no more questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Okay. Do I pronounce it Lau? Do I pronounce your last name Lau?
Yes.
Okay, Ms. Lau.
Good afternoon, Justice Herndon, Justice Lee, and Justice Perry-Gary, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Lau, and I'm with the Clark County District Attorney's Office on behalf of the Clark County Department of Family Services, who is the respondent in this matter. The appellant father and respondent child are aligned in their position that this court should reverse the district court's order terminating the father's parental rights. The Clark County Department of Family Services, however, is respectfully requesting that this court affirm the district court's decision to terminate parental rights, and in doing so, affirm that the district court had substantial evidence to support its findings, specifically clear and convincing evidence to establish parental fault, as well as that it was in the child's best interest for parental rights to be terminated. The child, GRS, was placed into protective custody when she was 4 years old. That was on August 8th, 2019. Approximately 24 months later, so 2 years, is when the district court terminated her father's parental rights, largely in part due to the appellant's history of unaddressed substance abuse. Appellant spent the first 15 months of this case of the child lingering in foster care, denying that he had any substance abuse history or issues at all. And he maintained that position until he was ultimately arrested for a probation violation in November 2020 related to possessing drug paraphernalia. It was at that point that it came to light appellant had in fact been using heroin every day that this case was open. It was not until April 2021, a near 18 or 19 months after the appellant was released from jail at CCDC, and I believe it was April 2021, where he was released upon the condition of drug court, that he started to consistently participate in any services. So over that 18 months of his child being in protective custody, and after over 18 months of assuring the district court that he did not have any substance abuse issues, did he then begin to engage in treatment? But yes.
So let me ask you this question. Should we prejudice somebody because of the point in time at which they have whatever epiphany they're going to have in life to kind of do better by themselves and their children? I mean, is the court foreclosed from considering that for some reason because of everything that occurred prior to that?
If it was a genuine action towards behavioral change, no. But that was not the case here. This was the appellant father getting revoked on his probation, sitting in CCDC, and getting reinstated on probation upon the condition of engaging in drug court or engaging in a drug treatment program. Appellant had...
So do you dispute that the report seemed to be that he was doing well in the drug court program and testing negative and completing the classes and kind of on a path that seemed to be progress?
I don't dispute that. Okay. However, it appears to be compliance-based because of the other outside factors that were motivating him to engage in that treatment at that time.
So I get the idea of being somewhat suspect about that, but what is the wisdom in allowing the state to use that suspect kind of mentality as both a shield and a sword here to say, we can't assess him because he's being overseen by the drug court program, so court, we can't help you right now. And then having the court say, well, because the state can't help me right now, then we just need to go ahead and move forward with terminating parental rights instead of waiting till a point in time that the state can, by its own admission, help me decide placement.
Well, as mentioned earlier, is the Adoption and Safe Families Act, ASFA, which is the federal law that requires the states proceed with termination of parental rights. In ASFA, it's if the child's been out of care 15 of 22 months. Here in Nevada, it's 14 out of 20. So the district court is somewhat bound by those timelines and wants to see
but
that.
But isn't that just for a presumption? That's just for a presumption, right? It doesn't say that you have to proceed to trial within 16 months. It doesn't mandate that the trial shall happen within that time frame, does it?
No, there's a separate statute that addresses once that termination of parental rights motion is filed. That's NRS 128055, which is the court has to use its best efforts to resolve that within 6 months. However, and then the presumptions, you're absolutely right. That is, if the child's been out of care 14 of 20 months, it's presumed the parent has made token efforts. It's presumed that it's in the best interest of the child. However, because of the length of time, I think that the district court gave appellant all these opportunities. If in the record, there's several instances of the district court. The termination of parental rights motion was filed in July 2020, and the trial did not commence until, I believe it was April 2021. So in that time period where the department did have to seek to terminate his parental rights, the district court was still giving him additional time. And it wasn't until November 2020, 4 months after the motion had been filed, that the appellant father did actually get revoked on probation, and that substance abuse issue really came to light. Given the record and kind of everything that had transpired thus far throughout the case, appellant was in denial. And I think that also contributed to the district court's findings, because 128.107 subsection 4 does require the district court to essentially look into the future as well.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but so the problem that the court is having is with his substance abuse. I haven't read anything in the record where he's actually neglected this child. I found no instances of neglect. And so I found the briefs a little light on the best interest of the child analysis, and not much deference was given to the child wanting to be reunited with the father. He has maintained sustained contact with this child. He visits with her frequently. He's maintained that bond. He's taken multiple courses. Some, I don't know if they were all mandated, but the PPP, the DV, the SafeNess, the anger management, the MRT, his drug tests have been coming up clean. And you're asking us to affirm a decision where this father will no longer have rights with his daughter. To me, that is the most serious thing that you can do to a family. And so I'm not sure that I'm convinced that he has been neglectful in putting this child in danger, particularly with all the efforts that he's made. So convince me otherwise.
So this child was removed when she was 4 years old. By the time we made it to trial, she was 6 years old, 24 months had passed, and father admittedly was not making any progress related to his substance abuse. While there may not be in the record a specific instance of neglect related to his substance abuse, the fact that that did exist at trial, he admitted he had a 15-year history of substance abuse. He was spending $3,000 a month on heroin. Let me
interrupt you on that. Can substance abuse alone, without any other consideration, equate to unfit parent?
If there's a nexus to how that impacts the child's raising,
exactly. So where was the nexus?
Ability here? to provide proper care. Well, it was a kind of a quandary for the district court, given that it has to look into the future and whether reunification is likely to occur within a predictable period. When we're at the point of a TPR trial 2 years in, and the father is just now deciding to address the substance abuse with the criminal court oversight, it raises the question of, is this rooted in true behavioral change? This court has found in the past that it's not enough to just comply with the case plan. It's about really learning the lesson and internalizing those lessons. And that's what I would attribute to the department's statements that, you know, we can't make a final assessment of his progress until he's out of this controlled environment.
Well, so wasn't let me ask you a question in that vein. Wasn't the court actually inclined to set this out after the first day of trial, set this out for a period of time to see how he was progressing, and then there was an objection to the court taking that action?
And there was an objection to the court taking that action because, again, the district court had given the father so many chances to get engaged in that service voluntarily and make that progress. And then it ultimately was the department's inability to make that final assessment, given that they couldn't reunify this child with dad within a predictable period. And at that point in time, his ability to reunify in general is speculative. And there comes a point in time, kind of just going back to the Adoption and Safe Families Act, where children cannot be at the mercy of their parents. And that's when these timelines...
At this point in time, wasn't he making what appeared to be extraordinary efforts that he hadn't made in the past?
He had, but again, it was just a challenge, I believe, for the district court to know for sure and to be able to say with certainty that were going to be long-lasting, sustainable behavioral changes after admittedly having a 15-year history of drug abuse as well as 18 months within this case alone, denying to the district court that there was any problem.
But you can't. You cannot, and we're asking you some tough questions. I appreciate this. But you cannot say you've had a history of drug abuse, you're on a path that appears to be progress, but we're just not going to trust that that's going to continue on because we've seen in the past where that doesn't happen, and therefore we're going to terminate parental rights, essentially impose the death penalty on your ability to parent your child. You're just kind of advocating a per se rule that the court should just distrust any addict that's making changes because of the potential that in the future they'll relapse.
Well, some of those things that the district court is looking for in that trial when appellant was engaged in treatment at that point is to see, you know, what are your triggers? What are your coping skills? Can you articulate to us what you've learned to assure us that this is not, you know, going to be a continued issue, which kind of goes back to what I was saying before about it's not enough to comply with the case plan. You have to show that you've learned the lessons. So in looking to the record, when dad was kind of asked some of these hard questions, he, on the first day of trial, he couldn't articulate any trigger to use drug use. He, on the third day of trial, admittedly could, but at that point he was engaging a little bit in that treatment for that point period of time. But on the third day of trial, after participating in adult drug court, he still could not articulate coping skills to use. There were additional concerns that were put on the record about the mother of the child in this case. She, at the point of trial, was still an active drug user. Father was upset when the department had asked that there be no contact between them. Dad didn't identify any really issue with still associating with someone that was actively using drugs and what threat that posed to his sobriety at the time that he was now engaging in adult drug court. So those, I think, were part of the considerations where he was engaging. Yes, he was going to adult drug court. He was going to treatment. But it's also looking towards, is he making those behavioral changes? Is he learning the things that he needs to learn? And at that point, the case had been open for, you know, at least, I think by the time the decision was made, it was about 2 years. So under AFSCA, the purpose of that is to avoid that unnecessary delay and lengthy stay in foster care. And every month, so let's say, you know, in the 14 months before the department has to initiate TPR, that's every month the child is in foster care, they're getting body checks. They're being taken into, you know, a room with essentially a stranger, a case manager, interviewing them. Their freedom of their ability to move is impacted. They can't leave the state without permission. They can't leave the country without permission. They can't associate with certain individuals.
Were the foster parents related to the child?
I believe they were. I believe they're related to the mother of the child.
Okay. So they're family?
Yes.
Okay.
Let me interrupt you again.
Yes.
I apologize. But I have a couple of technical questions and then a couple of questions about the judge and her order. Or one technical question, I guess. It did not appear to me that DCFS in any meaningful way, if at all, argued against the appellant and child's position on the failure to adjust part of the parental fault in the pleadings. I mean, is DCFS conceding that that's probably something that weighs in favor of appellant and minor child? I mean, that's something that should be relied on very cautiously to begin with. But I didn't see that it was opposed by the state.
Are you referring to the initial respondent's brief?
Yeah, the failure of the parent to adjust to the circumstances, kind of part of the unfit parent analysis.
So I believe that was addressed in the initial brief. It was failure of parental adjustment and unfitness are separate grounds, and it was, I believe it was addressed in the initial respondent's brief, and in that point there was no transcript.
Okay.
And the department was really merely working off of the order that the district court had filed, because there were no transcripts. We were working,
okay,
with very limited resources.
Okay.
To
so let me ask
that.
You about the order then. Because I'm reading the order, and one of the things cited by the judge as to why she did not want to continue this out was what she referred to, and I think it was number 7. She said the failure of there to be any change in the parent's behavior. And let me make sure I'm wording that right. On page 2 of her, is it page 2? Page 4, excuse me. Number 6, lack of behavioral changes made to date of either parent. When I read through her order, I find like no less than 4 or 5 occasions where she references Brandon's conduct signaling progress. Change began after Brandon's release from incarceration. Brandon completed anger management, relapse prevention, other programs, moved to 4-week reviews in drug court, had his ankle bracelet removed. I mean, how can you make reference to those things and then say there's been no behavioral change, so therefore I'm not going to continue this any longer? Seems kind of inconsistent.
It does say in the order as well that the fact that the father had been essentially denying that drug use for the months, over a year before he started engaging in treatment, it did cast a shadow of doubt on whether he was being truthful with the court, whether that was going to be able to be maintained. And the entire time, in looking to the entire timeline of the case, it was 19 months that he did not engage in any treatment. And by the end, 3 or 4 months is when he started making treatment or making progress in treatment. And that is a token effort at best, right? The TPR motion is pending. You are running out of time. And then with Mr. Spino as well, he had the added drug court requirements. So essentially my reading of the order is that it was speculative at best that this would be maintained once past the trial. And I'm running out of time. If I could address one last point.
Go ahead. I'll give you a little bit of time and then I have one final question.
Thank you. Just in regard to the representation that the district court did not consider her her capacity or her desires, I believe it's clear in the order that it was NRS 128-107 is the statute that needs to be addressed. And in that first part of the analysis, the district court does reference the appellant not providing for her physical, mental, or emotional needs. That's verbatim right from the statute. It also references that she is 6 years old, and she's not discounting the child's position. There's reference that in the order that says the record is clear that she is bonded with the father. I think that the order did show that it evaluated the child's capacity and just ultimately determined that a six-year-old child, although these are her wishes, it's not going to be the deciding factor. And the court had a difficult task to do what was in the best interest of this child, not necessarily what it is that she wanted at the time.
So you think the best interest of the child is of paramount importance?
Yes.
So in a 49-page court order, best interest of the child is referred to in 2.5 pages, one page of which is just a recitation of the statute and the conditions. So do you think she spent enough time analyzing the best interest of the child?
I think she did, because I think she addressed, and excuse me as I just go to my notes, where she did reference the main criteria in establishing what is in the best interest. So, you know, ability to meet the physical, mental, emotional needs, the fact that the child was in a committed adoptive resource placement with her half-siblings, as well as the placement's ability to meet the child's needs, and the fact that this was the only safe and secure home this child had been in for the foreseeable period of time.
Any questions, Justice Perry-Gary?
No.
All right, Ms. Lau, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will give counsel 2 minutes added to rebuttal, since we went 2 minutes over.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just address a few points. Counsel pointed out that they and the district court were working without transcripts, which is true. As the CAP attorneys coming in on appeal, we requested those transcripts. The district court's order was drafted without the assistance of transcripts. And so I want to go back to this issue of the triggers or coping skills. The district court in its order says that Brandon said he didn't know, he couldn't articulate any coping skills. And I'm not sure if that was an issue with the court's note taking or whatnot, but the transcript is clear. This is at in the transcript, so this would be our appendix, 2@495 and 2@283, where Brandon is asked about these so-called coping mechanisms. And the initial question's not immediately clear, but he does then articulate several coping mechanisms. He talks about contacting a sponsor, he talks about contacting another friend who he's been helping, he talks about contacting his brother, he talks about being around his daughter, meaning that he wouldn't be using while he's with her. Talks about listening to music, going for a walk, and then he says, write it down. I think he's referring to writing down his experience of going through his sobriety. And the context for saying, I don't know, is actually explaining whether he'll have urges to use again. So the full context is, I don't feel like I'm going to, meaning I don't feel like I'm going to have those urges, but obviously I don't know for sure. So if it happens, I'll just revert back to those coping skills. I believe that's the only time he says, I don't know. And then again, in an earlier question, he says, make sure I'm not being around people that are using, get rid of old contacts, and he discusses breathing techniques. So the idea that he had no coping mechanisms, even though this was admittedly fairly early in his treatment, because again, he wasn't given the opportunity to complete drug court, he still, even at that stage, was able to articulate those coping mechanisms. Number two, I want to address your point, Justice Herndon, about substance abuse being on its own a reason to terminate parental rights. You're right, it's not. In NRS 128-106D, it has to be to such a degree that it affects the well-being of the child. And we have in the Corey LG case, In Re AG 129, Nevada 125, the issue if the child is not being neglected or abused because of the drug use, that's the fact that the parent uses drugs isn't on its own a basis for terminating parental rights. Here, though, I'm willing to say, look, we do need Brandon to be sober. He did demonstrate his sobriety. And in fact, the state's own witness conceded, and this is at 3-6-12, that he was attending Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, even though that wasn't even part of his required case plan. He wasn't required to do that. He was doing that on his own. And the final point I just want to make is on the timing. Again, we heard reference to the federal statute. There are no federal limits on when a district court can issue a continuance in order to get all of the evidence to see if the parent is able at that point in time. We've heard a lot about the first 19 months, and I don't have a defense for the first, before he was incarcerated in November 2020. I agree with that, but I think he made a change. I think the district court even noticed that he was starting to make that change, but it just felt constrained by the timelines that frankly it had discretion to extend that timeline. In the In Re Parental Rights as to NJ case, which is 16 Nevada 790, it also talks about this ability of the district court to spend additional time. I understand the statute that says, use its best efforts to get it done in 6 months, but the best interest of the child certainly trump this. And it's not just at one point in time. Today, it is our position, it's the child position, that she wants to be reunited with her father.
Is the father still clean today?
My understanding is yes, he's sober today. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any questions, Justice Perrier?
Nope, I don't have any questions. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
So thank you all very much. Appreciate your time and efforts today. What great arguments, and we'll take this matter under advisement.